This week on Your Western Context, ethics issues in Alberta don't get covered fairly. BC's safe supply is getting sold on the streets, and coal plants will become illegal to run after 2030. Also, Trudeau's new clean fuel standards will increase inflation and hit the poor the hardest. This is Western Context, episode 320, recorded Saturday, May 20th, 2023. Come and get me. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Western Context. Patrick and myself are back this week as we head into the final full week of the Alberta election campaign. We also have some other news stories spanning, of course, the country, and of course, these news stories also do indeed touch your pocketbook. So it's something that we definitely want to be talking about this week.
Yes, for sure. As we head into the final week of the Alberta election campaign, we also enter into the final week of May coming up. So definitely as things are starting to get hotter, we are going to be looking at some news stories over the past week that have certainly grabbed our attention and weren't really covered quite fully by the mainstream media in the way that they should have.
That's right. And if you're joining us for the first time, Western Context has been around since 2017. And our business here, week by week, is to go through the news that you find, whether it be in the news that you watch on TV, that you read in the newspaper, and of course, as it is today in 2023, most of the news most people read comes from the internet. We look at all this, and our whole goal is to provide a picture of what's going on in Canada and Western Canada in particular, and provide all the information and context necessary out there to put you, our listeners, on the right side of the news. And our main goal in doing that is, of course, to remove the bias and sensationalism that you find in all of those stories, because that's so very important, as everything that we're going to be talking about this week either touches your pocketbook or deals with policy issues that people in Alberta might be concerned with, and people on the federal scene are going to be concerned with next time we vote there, and what's actually happening in BC as well in relation to the ongoing opioid epidemic. Now, as we head into the final week of the Alberta election campaign, as we mentioned, we have to, of course, talk about Into the Report that was released Thursday into Danielle Smith's ethics transgression and other allegations that have been brought back to the forefront in a report by Alberta's Ethics Commissioner, Marguerite Trussler. Now, we go back to January on this, when this first started, in particular a CBC article, where they ran a story saying that they had received reports of emails saying that the Premier was in contact with Crown prosecutors. And of course, if that were indeed to be true, that would be a major, major transgression, since in our system we are supposed to have the separation of the executive and the judicial parts of our democracy. Now, we need to, of course, underscore with this, and we talked about this when this story first appeared, that CBC did not see the emails and the source remained anonymous. Later on in March, the CBC and the NDP dropped a phone call recording from controversial pastor Arthur Pawlowski, who is charged with respect to Alberta's Critical Defense of Infrastructure Act in relation to the Coutts border blockade in early 2022. Now, in that conversation, it has been made to look as though that the Premier is, of course, very favorable to Pawlowski, but the report says that portions of the call were definitely edited out to a point where Pawlowski made himself look more favorable, because it's expected that he took a more aggressive and threatening stance with the Premier. Now, in terms of how this call was set up, the call was supposed to be about the upcoming election, and that there was a word that it was thought that maybe Pawlowski might have had something that would help the UCP against the NDP, but both Premier Smith and Dr. Dennis Modry say that they were blindsided by the discussion of the charges that came up in the call. And for people who haven't heard of Dennis Modry before, he is the former CEO of the Alberta Prosperity Project. And this is where what was discovered in the ethics report and what was reported diverge, and they diverge greatly to a point where you start to see what was talked about this week had one glaring omission which will become clear as we move through this story. Now, of course, we talked about the fact that the call was supposed to be about policy, but in turn it ended up being about the charges, which blindsided the premier. But the conclusion of the report is that, at the end of the day, Danielle Smith did not contact the Crown prosecutors, but did try to influence the justice system. So while she shouldn't have done that, she did not do what the media reports initially said she did, and let's keep that in mind as we move forward through the story. The report also makes it abundantly clear that with sworn statements from all 44 Crown prosecutors who worked on the COVID and Coutts cases, and everybody from the Premier's office, that there was no direction from the Premier or Justice Minister to these officials. What did happen, though, and what we're learning more about now, is that the Premier did call Justice Minister and Attorney General Tyler Shandrum while he was on vacation in January to ask what extent he could be involved in the cases or actually speak to the prosecutors. And this was, of course, found to be the major transgression of what we know did indeed happen. Now, with this, the Premier should not have done this and needs to be aware that this is very, very close to what Justin Trudeau did with regards to Jody Wilson-Raybould and SNC-Lavalin. The difference here, of course, being is that when Jody Wilson-Raybould told Trudeau no, he fired her. Thankfully, Danielle Smith did not fire Justice Minister Tyler Shandrum. This week, Smith put out a statement confirming that she was, in her own words, gratified to read the Ethics Commissioner's findings, confirming that neither her nor anyone in her office tried to or did contact Crown prosecutors regarding any COVID-19 prosecutions. She said she also intends to ask the Ethics Commissioner to provide guidance on how to advance sensitive policy issues similar to this one with the Minister of Justice. The Ethics Commissioner said that there still may be sanctions to come for Danielle Smith after the election has concluded. Media reporting has, of course, focused on the discussion of whether or not Smith and others contacted the Crown prosecutors and whether or not there was an ethics breach, and rightly so, talk about the ethics breach. But what is absent from media reporting on this is the CBC's role and the role of other outlets that republished CBC's findings. First, the ethics report confirms that CBC never saw the emails in question. Secondly, the person who allegedly sent the emails to the CBC was incensed by this allegation and actually denied providing the emails to CBC on this. And this is astounding, since it confirms that's all that's needed to change a media cycle within Canadian media is the word from an anonymous source. And then following from that, every other major media outlet in the country picked up on this story that was built on something based on an anonymous source that we're looking right now, aside from Danielle Smith's conversation with Tyler Shandrum, everything else that CBC reported is looking to be fake. Now, whether or not that source is right or wrong, of course, speaks volumes as to what comes from any piece of writing. And this is something that we learned quickly here at Western Context since 2017. And as such, whenever we're talking about a new issue that's coming out on the scene, like as happened recently with the election interference in the case of China, there needs to be multiple sources and multiple confirmations of a story before it's elevated to being true. It's also truly disappointing that so many in the Canadian media ran with the CBC story and didn't actually bother to see if they could obtain the emails or confirm what was actually said or what was actually done. And we need to be clear on this, that Smith should not have asked that question to Minister Shandrum. And there's, of course, an argument to be made for the people in Smith's camp that maybe Smith was just advancing her own idea of what she might have wanted to do from the leadership campaign going forward. But at the end of the day, there are legal limitations of what the Premier can talk about and what the Justice Minister should be allowed to hear, since he's also the Attorney General. But that's something that might not, in the minds of people who are on Smith's camp, something that she might not be aware of, as she does not have a legal background. But going forward on this, we now know that there was no contact between Smith and Crown prosecutors on this case, or anybody in the Premier's office. And we know this because everybody who talked and was a part of this report in the interviews with the Ethics Commissioner talked to the Ethics Commissioner under sworn testimony. Now, the biggest thing about this story, that the media ran with information that didn't exist, as was confirmed by these sworn statements, that wasn't talked about in the media this week, unfortunately. And that speaks volumes of what the Canadian media landscape looks like in 2023. And, of course, that leads you to the next logical question. Will this have any impact on the election in a week and a bit? And the answer to that is probably not, but it speaks volumes about what we need to have our eyes open for as we move forward and as we keep watching and verifying what the media is saying.
It's very interesting to see this story surface and pretty much conclude at this point, especially as we're nearing towards the election. But also, it's so strange to see how this story has evolved over the past few months, and definitely the call with Artur Pawlowski and how that got changed and weaved, and what Premier Smith had said. It's just a very bizarre story that really seems more unnecessary than anything. But regardless of how unnecessary the story actually is, it is still important to look at how the media covered it and what they were talking about and how they were reporting the facts and what was actually going on versus the speculations and conjectures that the media ended up going with. And definitely, we want to see that, you know, there is a government that is not going to be having ethics problems. Certainly with the federal government, we've had a lot of that over the past few years. And we'd like to see a government that doesn't have tangles with the ethics commissioner. But certainly, we also want to see a media that will actually report on the story in as factual a way as possible. And we didn't really see that with this story. And there's many other stories where we haven't seen that as well.
Yeah. And what you get to at the end of the day on this is it puts you in a situation where anytime somebody needs to go to the media, CBC, Global, whoever, it can be anybody. Let's be 100% honest with that. It can be anybody. It's the CBC in this story, but it can be anybody. Anybody who goes to the media as an anonymous source after this, on either side of the political spectrum, and that's important to underscore, is going to have their credibility undermined because of this. And we know from history, there are cases where people need to be anonymous sources. And history tells us, in particular with most of the cases that have followed in the U.S. on these sorts of stories, whenever it does come to anonymous sources, there always needs to be more than one verification on this. And that's what builds the ability to verify the stories that are happening. And if you can't do that, the media loses an important lever for it to turn. And that's why this is such a big story this week for Alberta. But, you know, we say it's an Alberta story, but it's also a Canada story in that we've had lots of ethics transgressions at the federal level in the last 8 years. And we wind up in a situation there where, well, following this, people are just going to trust the media less and less, and that's not a good thing because of where their trust has been and where they land. And that's why we do this each and every week here at Western Context. And if you want to help us with that, you can support us monetarily on Patreon at patreon.com/Western Context. And we offer three tiers of support there, starting for as little as $2 a month. You can help us remove bias and sensationalism from the news and media. For $5 a month, you can continue to help us do that and have your name read out on the podcast if you want. For $10 a month, you can become a Western Context insider and gain an insight into our work and gain pre-release access to our production and show notes throughout the entire week. Now, of course, if you also want to make a one-time contribution as well via PayPal, you can do that by visiting westerncontext.ca/support, and we, of course, appreciate your support. But with that, we're moving on to BC right now, but this is, just like the Alberta story, is another story that has ramifications for the entire country.
Yes, indeed. And there was a huge question that was bandied about the BC legislature this past week, of course, in the wake of a National Post story that was a very well-written article that we have linked in our supplementals that every listener should go at least have a skim of, because it really lays waste to the story that is going on right now, which is, are opioids that are prescribed to drug users as a part of British Columbia's Safer Supply program being diverted and sold on the streets instead. And that's a very strong accusation that is coming from this National Post story that claims that significant quantities of the opioid hydromorphone, otherwise known as Dilaudid, is being prescribed to people with substance use disorder and are being then sold or traded for stronger drugs that have fentanyl in it. Now, a reporter from Global News tested that claim in Vancouver's downtown east side and demonstrated that this phenomenon of diversion is not just anecdotal. In fact, the reporter was actually able to buy 26 tablets of hydromorphone in just under 30 minutes for $30. Now, BC United mental health and addictions critic Eleanor Sturco alleged in question period that, quote, diverted Safe Supply pills that used to sell for $10 a pill are now being sold for as low as 25 cents a pill. And they're now being sold around Vancouver General Hospital and downtown because of the government's flooding of the market. Now, in an interview, Sturco said that she'd heard from several doctors working in the field who wished to remain anonymous out of fear of professional repercussions, who claimed that physicians at St. Paul's Hospital's Rapid Access Addictions Clinic had stopped prescribing hydromorphone and were also starting to deprescribe their patients. Now, Sturco said, quote, they're talking about not seeing any overall improvement in the condition of their patients and also, unfortunately, seeing an increase in the number of individuals, including youth, coming in with new onset opioid use disorder, which, of course, is a huge concern. They're saying that they recognize a lot of diversion is happening. They're turning around and selling those so that they can get the street drugs that they're craving. And as a result, other people are then obtaining Dilaudid and becoming users of that drug, which is actually five times more powerful than morphine. Now, several BC doctors who specialize in addiction did share similar concerns and say that they know some portion of the hydromorphone that they prescribe is being diverted to the street trade, and that they've not seen data that shows that the program is reducing overdose deaths, and that they feel that there's a political climate right now that's discouraging doctors with dissenting opinions from speaking up. Now, BC issued new guidelines on prescribing opioids to people with substance use disorders early in the COVID-19 pandemic in a bid to reduce street drug deaths and to break people with addictions away from drug dealers and better connect them with healthcare and services. Now, Sarah Blythe, who is a longtime harm reduction worker and executive director of Vancouver's Overdose Prevention Society, said that the number of people who actually have access to prescribed small safe supply is so small that any drugs being diverted would be a drop in the bucket compared to the volume of toxic drugs on the street. Blythe argued that any hydromorphone making its way onto the street would be a net benefit given the high toxicity of street drugs that are already circulating. So while this number coming out from Vancouver's Overdose Prevention Society is intended to say that safe supply is working, instead what it says is that it's so little of an impact because it reaches so few people that it's almost like the program isn't working to actually help the situation whatsoever. Now, the latest report on unregulated drug deaths from the BC Coroner's Service found that fentanyl was present in 86% of suspected toxic drug fatalities. Now, the same report concluded that, quote, there is no indication that prescribed safe supply is contributing to illicit drug deaths. But given the fact that 86% of those suspected drug fatalities included fentanyl, that means that there's only up to 14%, possibly quite a bit less than 14%, that the safe supply is actually helping to reduce. Now, and yet it also showed that toxic drug deaths are continuing to rise, with at least 596 deaths just in the first 3 months of the year alone, which is setting the province on track for a potentially record year for drug fatalities. Now, at least 2,314 deaths were due to toxic drugs recorded in 2022, making it the deadliest year on record since BC declared a public health emergency back in 2016 over drugs overdoses and started actually legislating to do something to fix the problem. So ever since then, it's just gotten worse. Now, BC has tried to introduce the safe supply to counteract the tainted supply, but by their own admission, the amount of prescribed safe supply is so low that it isn't making that much of a difference. All the while, people die every day due to fentanyl overdoses. And for this, we now go to the United States, just to our neighbors to the south of BC, and certainly where they've been having a lot of problems with overdoses there as well, because this isn't just a BC issue. It isn't just a Canadian issue. It's pretty much a North American issue at this point. Now, an hour down the road from Vancouver, just over the border, is the U.S. port city of Bellingham, Washington. Now, mostly known for its craft beer and hippie vibe, as the West Coast usually is, it's long held a reputation for being one of the most progressive, laid-back cities in Washington state. And over the years, it has been a reliable ally of the Democratic Party at election time. Now, this is why a recent move by the city council there is quite shocking, given its laid-back nature. Because they made a decision to authorize police to arrest people who are injecting, ingesting, or inhaling drugs such as fentanyl or methamphetamine on downtown streets. Now, like many, if not most cities in the U.S., Bellingham is facing a drug crisis. Now, it's been sympathetic to arguments from public health experts that arresting people for drug use is stigmatizing and discourages them from getting treatment. But it also drives users into darker corners of society to consume, where responding to overdoses is more difficult. Now, consequently, there is more death with this approach, or so the argument goes. But in response to this, there is a corollary problem with that approach, because open drug use in the downtown core of cities quite rightly scares people away. Now, it hurts small businesses trying to survive. It turns once thriving blocks into boarded up zones of misery inhabited primarily by drug users and sellers. Now, this is a scene that has seen many repeats across Canada and in the US. Now, this problem resonates especially strongly in BC, where there is an emotional debate going on around the province's decision back in January to decriminalize the possession of personal amounts of illicit drugs on a trial basis. Now, NDP Premier David Eby was recently confronted with these tough questions from the BC United Party about the mess that this new policy has created in many cities. Now, municipalities in the interior and the province in particular have seen a dramatic spike in open drug use in parks, on beaches, and in playgrounds. Now, mayors in places such as Kamloops and Kelowna are now confronting situations just like Bellingham's, where people who are afraid to go downtown or to public spaces because of the chance or even likelihood that there will be someone there taking hard drugs and often displaying erratic behavior. Now, federal conservative leader Pierre Poilievre doubled down on his criticism of the federal government's approach to dealing with the opioid crisis and insinuated that advocates of the Safe Supply program are activists or willfully perpetuating the crisis to make money. Now, his comments came as conservatives used their Opposition Day motion in the House of Commons to ask the government to reverse its policy of offering a safe supply of drugs to people who are at high risk of an overdose and instead redirect the money to treatment and recovery programs. Now, in his opening speech on Thursday, Poilievre accused Prime Minister Justin Trudeau of having implemented a, quote, theory backed up by a group of activists, most of them tax-funded pharmaceutical companies and others who stand to gain from perpetuating the crisis. Now, he said, quote, these so-called experts are typically pie-in-the-sky theorists with no experience getting people off drugs or their memories of the misery industry, those paid activists and public health bureaucrats whose job depends on the crisis continuing. Now, while health experts and parties like the NDP and federal Liberals claim that so-called safe supplies of drugs will reduce deaths, in BC that just has not been the case. And while Premier David Eby claims that he will, quote, do something to stop the crisis, it's clear that what has been tried already has not helped. Now, perhaps it's time to try a different approach.
And this story is very shocking, because you would expect that if the government makes the decision that, well, we're gonna go down the safe supply track, that's what the drugs are going to be used for and they're going to help. And it's not actually going to be used to turn people into dealers and sell those products on the street. And what you wind up here with is a very interesting dichotomy, because you have, as we see here, the conservatives interestingly moving more towards the path of treatment and recovery, which a lot of people never really put that on as being a conservative policy. But lo and behold, we see that here with the Federal Conservative Party of Canada in the election in Alberta. That's the way that the UCP is going. And conversely with that, if you flip the side, the idea of safe supply is something else that has also been pushed by the NDP in Alberta. And it's just so interesting to see the parallels on these parties and seeing where this ends up. And a lot of people in Canada have held up BC for experimenting on these sorts of things in the past, going back years and years. But at the same time, we don't really hear about what the ramifications of this are going to be and how it's actually acting once we see the results and what's happened to the surrounding communities. That's something that's definitely not talked about enough in the media, and that's what this story does. And it is framed very much in a way that this is a BC and even just a Vancouver story. But what you have here is effectively a set of situations that have been created by government policy that aren't being talked about federally. And this becomes the reality for every other major city that is struggling with opioids in this country. And unfortunately, all of them are. And this is the path. This is what happens on the safe supply route.
Yes, it's interesting to see that the government has been, you know, almost experimenting with different ways to help the overdose crisis and try and reduce the amount of deaths that we've seen. Because, you know, after all, they've been trying to work on this for 7 years, since 2016. They've certainly been aware of the problem for at least that long, and really have been trying to come up with different programs that can help alleviate the problems. But what they've come up with has led to an increase in overdose deaths, has led to a lot of money being spent on these programs, and has led to, well, a lot of people coming to the province and have indulged in this safe supply that is now being sold on the streets, which is something that even the government probably didn't factor in to their approach, that people would just be getting rid of the safe supply and instead trading it for the street drugs. And, you know, at the end of the day, this is a problem that has been going on in many different cities. It's been affecting BC, of course, the most in Canada, but this is not just a BC problem. This is a North American problem, and it's something that's going to continue unless governments actually put in real solutions that will stop this from happening. We can't go down the conservative line of the past where it was just criminalized, because that's not going to stop people from using drugs. We can't go down the path of the modern Liberal and NDP movements, because quite clearly that path isn't working. And instead, maybe it's time we choose a different path, the more modern conservative path of treatment and harm reduction, because we're seeing right now with the overdose deaths that have been climbing in the province and continue to climb year after year, well, what the government has been doing over the past decade quite clearly hasn't worked, and maybe it's time they do something different.
Yeah, and it's interesting how it's a reversal, because you go back 10, 15 years, you would find that the recovery and treatment option was the middle of the road option, and in some cases was even the left of center option. And it's just weird how things like that have moved over time. And you have to wonder, we got to this point here where it's so bad that we definitely do need to go down this path. But at the same time, there needs to be concrete action taken, because you get to a point where you walk downtown, you're going to be inhaling this secondhand smoke from these people. That's not just regular secondhand smoke. It's downright poisonous secondhand smoke, and people don't want that, and people are going to see that over time. And as we all know, it's better to fix these kind of problems before they become bigger and lead to huge political upsets that can cause even more problems along the way. But we're going to shift gears now. We're going to talk about something that comes out of Saskatchewan, but in reality, it's something that's going to affect all Canadians on this in a net way. And with this, we had an interesting interaction between Premier Scott Moe and Federal Environment Minister Stephen Guilbeault. Now, according to the Environment Minister, Saskatchewan will be breaking the law if it continues to run its coal-fired electricity plants after 2030 unless the emissions are captured. Violating these regulations would be an offense under Canada's criminal code. And that, of course, is the same criminal code where sits charges like murder and the like. Premier Scott Moe says that for the province to maintain reliable and affordable electricity, the province will need to keep running these coal-fired plants until the end of their lifespans. With this, Saskatchewan will also continue to run their natural gas plants until life's end, which puts the province on par in aiming for net zero by 2050. Now, this story saw very little coverage outside of Saskatchewan this week, and for people unaware of the story, it might be shocking. And while not specifically targeting the energy industry, the policy by the federal government is pursuing an ideological goal without the consideration of what the consequences will be for power bills. In a reminder for our listeners, Stephen Guilbeault is the environmental activist who scaled the CN Tower and was charged in the early 2000s and is now minister in charge for what our environmental goals and policies will be in this country. Those environmental goals appear to be ideological rather than practical, since provinces like Saskatchewan have put forward a 2050 net zero plan and have also committed to develop nuclear. Nuclear, of course, is a way forward to produce more clean energy in addition to further technological advancements in things like solar, wind, and hydro, but it's often overlooked by the federal government and by NDP political parties across the country. And in a bit of irony on this, the Alberta NDP's energy plans actually mirror that of Guilbeault's. In power, the Alberta NDP started the process of shutting down Alberta's coal power plants, and now, if elected, aim to be net zero by 2035, which would have the same consequences as what Guilbeault is proposing. The Saskatchewan spring legislative session also ended, and in that note, there was an interesting case of party solidarity between the Saskatchewan Party and the opposition NDP, in that the opposition NDP in Saskatchewan voted with the Saskatchewan Party to not implement the Net Zero 2035 plan. And to be clear here, we're looking at a 2030 limit for coal and a 2035 limit for natural gas. And this is very stark, and the comment that we get to this and we see which way the Saskatchewan government wants to go when we look at what Premier Scott Moe had to say this week. He said if where we've come to in this country is when individuals in this province or any other province flick their lights on or the furnace fan kicks in, that that's deemed illegal and causes for someone to go to jail, come and get me. And that's her quote of the week because of Scott Moe's stance and the ultimate end goal he has of likely showcasing how absurd the policy is of the federal environment ministry. And we're looking at a situation here in Saskatchewan, where 25% of their electricity comes from coal. And with that, there's not enough time to hit the 2030 or 2035 target. And with that arbitrary move being planned by Guilbeault and the Liberals, energy prices will go up. And it will wind up creating a case of artificial energy scarcity that will cause prices for consumers at the end of the day to go up. And as everybody knows, energy is very important when it's dark and cold for 6 to 8 months of the year. And we end this story by highlighting again the similar path that the Alberta NDP would take if they were elected and the lack of support for nuclear from folks like Guilbeault, Notley, Justin Trudeau, and the federal NDP on this. In addition, the 2030 targets should just worry everybody, and that's something that's not being talked about this week, because this is, on its own, very clearly a Saskatchewan story. But these sorts of same ideas could be expanded out and become even more radical and start impacting more people across the country.
Yes, and what is actually missed from this story is this doesn't actually just affect Saskatchewan. It affects places like Nova Scotia as well, which is also has coal plants and is not able to access any hydroelectric power because it's not any near any rivers that have the ability to produce hydroelectric power. Well, it doesn't have any natural sources of natural gas nearby. And, well, it has to import a lot of its energy from abroad. So the coal plants were the only way to actually use that energy in province. So we're seeing both in Saskatchewan and in Nova Scotia, and to lesser extents, a lot of other places around the country as well, that this 2030 goal of this As we mentioned, it's only 7 years away. 7 years ago was 2016. It's hard to believe that that has been 7 years at this point. So as we can see, 2030 is going to come up very quickly. And it's going to be very difficult for these provinces to be able to actually stop this from happening. And, well, we saw what happened when provinces and countries ditch nuclear power to go to different energy sources. There just isn't enough energy to go around, and they have to go back to the tried and true method of coal. Now, of course, while coal power plants generally are not as good for the environment as, say, natural gas or hydroelectric power or nuclear power, sometimes you just don't have any other options. And right now, that's where Saskatchewan and Nova Scotia are in right now. And certainly we saw this in Germany, which recently shut down their nuclear power plants. And well, that led them to have to deal more with natural gas and with coal, which actually put them under the thumb of Russia even more. And that's going to happen in Canada, too. If we're shutting down our domestic energy sources, we're going to have to rely on importing energy, generally imported energy from Canada and North America comes in from Venezuela, or it comes from the west coast of Africa, or it comes from the Middle East. And that's something that we don't really want to see happen. So while we're looking at trying to improve the environment going forward and trying to reduce the harmful effects of climate change, making concrete bans like this is not really the way to go, especially if there is a way that we can get going under alternate power sources like nuclear or hydroelectric. Well, maybe the government should be incentivizing those rather than punishing places that don't have the access to those resources.
And what this underscores, again, this is 100% artificial energy scarcity. The very situation that developing countries are trying to get out of and will do anything to get out of. Because you have to keep in mind that in a lot of these countries, they burn wood and many other things that are far more emissive than what we have in terms of our very clean coal and natural gas. And that's something that's not talked about as well. And this is going to have ramifications across the entire country. But first, as we get closer to Canada Day, in our firing line, we have another thing on the energy file that people are going to start feeling right away.
Yes, exactly. And it's a generally accepted maxim that for governments, you want to give tax breaks on actions that you want to encourage, and then tax those that you mean to discourage. Now, that's why we have tax breaks for TFSAs and RRSPs, because it's accepted that people should save for their retirement. That's why there are taxes on cigarettes and alcohol to encourage people to stop drinking and smoking. Now, in a good governed society, that's how it should work, where taxes and tax breaks are governed based on actions. But in present-day Canada, taxes are not based around actions, but on wealth and power. Now, higher and higher taxes have been hitting the common working Canadian, and tax breaks instead exist for the wealthy and powerful individuals and mega corporations who can afford to hire rich lawyers to find ways to pay less into a society that's benefiting them. Now, income taxes have shot up, which have punished people for working extra. Payroll taxes have shot up, punishing small businesses disproportionately to big foreign multinational corporations. Now, even the carbon tax has shot up, punishing those workers who make the least in our society by making it unaffordable to even get to work. Now, the Parliamentary Budget Officer, who is the nonpartisan role defined to look at the federal government's spending and expenses and to see how different policies by the federal government will affect life in Canada. Well, they recently released a report looking at the federal government's clean fuel regulations and how the standards on producers or importers of gas or diesel is intended to gradually reduce the carbon intensity of the fuels that they sell. Now, by 2030, which is another very coincidental date that has come up, the carbon intensity of these fuels must fall to 15% below 2016 levels. Now, according to Environment and Climate Change Canada, this will deliver 26 million tons of greenhouse gas emission reductions. Now, they say that by increasing the price of carbon-intensive fuels, the government hopes to encourage the production and consumption of cleaner fuels like hydrogen and biofuels. Now, it should be noted that BC, California, Oregon, and others have already adopted similar regulations. Now, these are also areas of the North American continent that have among the highest gas prices. Now, once these regulations take full effect, according to figures the PBO obtained from Environment and Climate Change Canada, it will actually increase the price of gas and diesel by as much as 17 cents per liter. Now, the Canadian economy will also take a hit, the PBO reported, with the regulations decreasing real GDP in 2030 by up to 0.3% or $9 billion. Now, the PBO also estimated that the cost would range from 0.62% of disposable income, or $231, for lower-income households to 0.35% of disposable income, or $1,008, for higher-income households. Now, Yves Giroux, the PBO, said, quote, "Since lower-income households generally spend a larger share of their income on transportation and other energy-intensive goods and services, compared to higher-income households, on average, the clean fuel regulations will have a greater impact on those households." Now, this is true. Taxes and inflation generally hit those with less money more than those who have more money to spend. Now, the report also says, quote, "Relative to household disposable income, PBO results show that the clean fuel regulations are broadly regressive. That is, the cost to lower income households represents a larger share of their disposable income compared to higher income households." Now, regressive taxes that hit lower income people should be discouraged in today's society, but even the so-called progressive parties like the NDP and the Liberals are taking the approach that any taxes are a good thing. Now, outside the House of Commons on Thursday, Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre said that the regulations will cause a significant hardship to families, especially combined with the national carbon price, which will rise to $170 per ton in 2030. Poilievre said, quote, "It's yet another tax on the back of hardworking Canadians," and he called the clean fuel regulations carbon tax number two. Now, while the clean fuel regulations are not actually a tax, since all the money paid goes directly to oil and gas companies, it's still an extra cost on Canadians. And since the money is going to big corporations, it will still spike inflation extra upon what is actually there already. Now, Poilievre said that the Trudeau Liberals are bringing in this policy when Canadians are already struggling. He said, quote, "This at a time when bankruptcies and insolvency are on the rise, and one in five Canadians are skipping meals because they can't afford the price of food." Now, it should be noted that food banks are seeing record numbers and are already buckling under the pressure of so many people needing even just basic food that should be easy to afford, but isn't. Now, the Liberals have said that the PBO's report ignores the costs of doing nothing to fight climate change and the costs that that will incur on the Canadian population. Now, the PBO acknowledged that his report doesn't consider both the costs and benefits of policies in addressing climate change, but he added that such an analysis would also need to factor in not only what Canada is doing, but what other countries are doing as well. Now, Canada, which in 2019 was responsible for 1.9% of global CO2 emissions, can do little to affect change when the top three countries by population account for over half of all world CO2 emissions. Now, China, at almost 30% of the entire world, is by far the biggest offender of global climate change threat. Now, Poilievre argued that the report is yet another added cost that the Liberals have unnecessarily heaped onto Canadians as they strive to reduce Canada's greenhouse gas emissions. He pointed to the federal requirement that all provinces have a minimum carbon price, which is set to increase from the current $65 per ton to $170 per ton in 2030. Now, earlier this year, the PBO released a report that said that the total impact of the carbon tax was actually higher than the Trudeau government was claiming. They said, quote, "Based on our analysis, most households will pay more in fuel charges and GST, as well as receiving slightly lower incomes than they will receive in climate action incentive payments." Now, the whole point of the tax was that so the low-income people weren't punished, but instead, they're actually punished far more. Now, the sad thing is, all of these charges that Trudeau has brought in are supposed to be about lowering Canada's carbon emissions, which is something that hasn't happened and likely won't in the near future. Now, Dan McTeague, who is the president of the Canadians for Affordable Energy, said that the cost of the standard on top of the existing carbon tax, compounded by the current cost of living, just isn't affordable for many. Now, McTeague said that the standard is a second measure after the carbon tax applied by the government to reduce emissions from liquid fuels like diesel and gasoline, which is something that he has not seen any other country attempt and could become very expensive for taxpayers in the future. McTeague said, quote, "We are now going to burden Canadians for what is an intolerable price to pay. At the end of the day, I'm not sure that we can have our combines, mining vehicles, and our transport infrastructure, including rail, all done on hydrogen and battery, and certainly not by 2030. Now, at the end of the day, that's going to be the end result. A farming industry that is too expensive to not pass on the costs of food to Canadians. Natural resources industries that become unprofitable and job-cutting, as well as huge increases in taxes to pay for infrastructure that people can't afford to use. Now, Canadians are reaching their breaking point with taxes and inflation. Now, while Canada should be concerned about climate change, it's not something that these taxes will fix."
There needs to be a great paradigm shift when it comes to this and the reality of what we're looking at on this, and understand that in a petri dish, the idea of a carbon tax might make sense. But at the end of the day, when prices of everything start going up for that, you really have to question, and people are suffering, is that worth it at the end of the day? And maybe there needs to be some comparative analysis done in realization that there is no carbon tax in the U.S. Joe Biden, in his 2020 election bid, did not run on instituting a carbon tax for the entirety of the U.S. And as such, that would leave it up to a state-by-state approach, and you can bet that the vast majority of the U.S. states are not going to do something like that simply because it hurts their competitive advantage, and it's going to make things more expensive at the end of the day for their citizens. And that's something that people don't seem to realize here, is that you can't look at economic issues in a silo. You have to realize and understand that you're competing globally. You're competing with the U.S. You're competing with the EU. You're competing with Asia. And if those countries are not hobbling themselves in the same way that we do with regulations, taxes, and so on and so forth, our economies just need to perform that much better to be on par with them to bring that investment into the country. And that's something that we've been lucky with, that we've been able to actually see positive investment growth in the shadow of the pandemic, which is a good thing. But nobody stops to ask the question, what would the energy industry look like in Canada had there been no carbon tax, had there been no regulatory hurdles that forced the government to buy Trans Mountain, that killed Energy East, and a government didn't kill Northern Gateway? What if that had happened? What would the energy industry look like here? And maybe there would be more money flowing through the Canadian economy that we could actually invest in some of these green initiatives without needing to rely on the carbon tax.
Yes, you obviously can't take a journey without taking the first step. And to take the first step is to make Canada economically sufficient so that we can actually have the money available to buy these greener initiatives, as well as nuclear power, which across many of the provinces of Canada could work to displace a lot of the problems that the high carbon fuels actually produce. And certainly this is something that probably should have been done about 10 years ago or so. But instead, we got a federal government that is planning on putting more and more costs onto Canadian consumers, and instead, at the same time, raking in that money. And where is it going? It's not going to nuclear initiatives. It's not going to greener fuels. It's going straight into the government coffers instead, or into big national companies that can certainly afford to reduce their prices just a little bit to help the Canadian consumers. But instead, we're getting all of the problems, but we're getting none of the solutions. And that's par for the course for this federal government. But definitely, we've seen this happening for quite some time. And as you said, it would be interesting to see if the government had been able to build those pipelines across the country so that Canadians can enjoy more Canadian energy rather than having to rely on imported Canadian imported energy from abroad, but also to be able to import more of our Canadian energy abroad so that a lot of other places around the world that don't have as clean of an energy infrastructure as we do can actually enjoy those benefits as well, all while supplying Canada with the money needed to better our infrastructure grid. Not something that would have been smart to do 10 years ago and would still be smart to do today. But Canada has lost so much in opportunity and revenue. And by not being able to exert our control over the energy industry over the world, we've lost that influence to be able to try and get others to change their fuel standards and get going. Because what can Canada do to try and get China or India or the United States or Russia to actually stop their polluting ways? Well, it's hard to know because Canada doesn't have that world influence going forward. And what we can do is focus on our own, but at a very measly less than 2%. What is Canada going to do on its own that can solve climate change? The answer is absolutely nothing. So while we're now spending a lot of money on these issues and a lot of money is getting taken away from the Canadian populace, we're still going to be racked with the climate change problems that are happening. And many of the activists will say, well, we could have done more. If we had done more sooner, it would have helped. But, you know, at the end of the day, we're probably going to have these problems regardless of what Canada decides to do, all because of what countries like China are doing. And they're building up their economy without actually reducing their emissions. This means that they're having a huger impact on the world of climate change. And, well, at the end of the day, if that's something you're concerned about, it's not something that Canada can do alone. It's something that the world has to deal with. And if Canada is just putting these punitive taxes on its citizens, that's not actually fixing climate change. It's not actually reducing emissions. So this is something that we need a dramatic shift in policy to actually fix. If that is a problem that Canadians want to have solved, then this is something that the current policies are not going to fix.
Yeah, and with this, you also just underscore how important it is for technology and innovation to play a key role, because when it comes to technologies like batteries and supercapacitors and whatnot, that's what's going to make solar viable. When it comes to looking at things like nuclear, small modular reactors, the new technology behind that is what's going to make it more feasible to develop nuclear energy across the country. And you combine that by slowly moving away from the fossil fuels, you end up in a situation where you're far better off than you would have been by taxing and spending before you're ready to do that. It comes down to a balanced approach between leveraging the economy you have and the technology without being too heavy-handed on the government side. And with that, I think we can move on to our word of the week.
Yes, our word of the week this week is regulation, which is defined as rules set by an authority in order to control an organization or system. And certainly the regulations that the Canadian government has put in place on the energy industry and on anybody using energy, which includes everybody in using gas to fill up your car to go to work, or going to the grocery store to buy food that has been trucked there by trucks or flown across airplanes or been grown by tractors being used by farmers all across the country. All of it uses energy to get and to exist in our modern life. You have to use its energy. And that means that the federal government is using its regulations to control the entire organization or system of the entirety of Canada. And we have to decide whether these regulations are doing things for the benefit of the common good or if they're just benefiting the government. And at the end of the day, that is the main question that will be asked in the future election.
And a lot of people don't realize that, and when it comes to it, you'd think that energy is a boring topic to discuss, but it's certainly not boring when it affects your pocketbook at the end of the day, and that's something that we've talked about from at least two of our stories this week, so that's a good angle for us to be at here. But, of course, as we mentioned, we're heading into that final week of the election campaign. All of our stories here are available at westerncontext.ca, including full supplementals. For that, we invite you to read and look at our show notes there. You can also subscribe to the podcast on any number of podcast listeners out there. We're on Apple Podcasts, Google, Pocket Casts, Spotify, and more at westerncontext.ca/subscribe. And of course, we're also on Twitter and Facebook at Western Context, where we share the shows and some of the stories that we're looking at throughout the entire week. So with that being said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context.
And we'll be sure to look through all the stories that the mainstream media is talking about and a lot that they aren't talking about, and going over what the stories are each week and how they matter to Canadians. Now, we'll do this whether the show, whether the stories are in TV, radio, print, or online. We will find them and we will give you the context needed to put yourselves on the right side of the news. So with that said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context.